Chapter 2, What I Was Waiting For, the W.C. Lattice. Way back in 2005, I embarked upon the process of addressing what I'll call an urgent internal issue. In this case, not so much a psychological crisis, but rather a theme my mind kept returning to, accompanied by a strong unconscious push to find a solution. It began when Michelle gave me the book Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality, SES for short, by Ken Wilber for our anniversary in 2004. A big long book, I took it to Mysore, India for Patabi Joyce's 90th birthday in July the following year and sat there in my Gokulam flat at a beat-up plastic table for 6 weeks, taking notes in the hot nights after the rest of the family had retired into the mosquito net. I kept at it because it was one of the few spiritual books I've ever read where I got a keen sense that some grand revelation was going to come from getting to the end of it. I'd encountered variants on the phenomenon 3 times before. 1. Jung's quote-unquote magnum, Mysterium Conjunctionis. It knocked me over in my early 20s as his full world came in, but finishing it was a Herculean chore. After I read the first 20 pages, something weird and wonderful appeared on my inner horizon. Again, I was in India doing intense yoga, and I felt Western and Eastern subtle contents merging together. This carried me through. I read every word, even most of the copious footnotes, to the last chapter where it all falls into place. 2. Shankaracharya's Brahma Sutra Bhashya. After an initial conversion experience, Vedanta in all its profundity, it wound up putting me into a coma every time I touched it. The book is longer than you can imagine, leaves no 8th century didactic stone unturned, and would have morphed me into Rip Van Winkle entirely if I hadn't done the right thing by putting it back on the shelf, thereafter only referring to it periodically, allowing me to return to normal waking consciousness. 3. Aurobindo's Life Divine, another book known to cause spontaneous sleep. Is it boredom or is it weighty transformational vibration? One of the biggest bricks you can find. The first 30 pages blew my head clean off and may do the same to you. I also found out how God comes down to earth. Such a large number of angles into this theme that I finally skipped to the part where a human rises up to God. Much more on this later. But Wilber's brick was clear and quite exciting in the way it integrated so much cutting-edge materialist thinking into a glorious, hard-won spiritual context. So I slapped at mosquitoes and finished, footnotes and all, wiser for the experience, and something wasn't quite right. There is a happy ending, though. 2 years later, I was teaching in Manhattan and realized that Wilber's Integral Spirituality had recently been published. And there it was, St. Mark's Bookstore, East Village, page 90, the thing I was hoping for but couldn't figure out myself, the W.C. Lattice, the icing on the cake of SES. It has taken several years, right up to the present day, for me to recognize the helpfulness of this tool. I feel thankful for Wilber and cohorts for getting it out there. I see it as the keystone to his overall model of human development, which is his primary project. Since then, he has added many refinements to the story, a few new ones each book, and I can't imagine a more thorough, carefully considered, and rigorously vetted model of human evolutionary process and potential, both in theory and in practice. His mature approach currently boils down to this. If 70% of the world's population is at us versus them levels of development or lower, how are we going to deal with the urgent problems facing humanity, such as climate change, which require a global perspective? So he puts his efforts into getting people to evolve in the fullest and fastest way possible. In this chapter, I'm using his basic developmental structures as the bones upon which to elaborate my own ideas about development and the cosmos. Sex, Ecology, Spirituality is where his mature basic map originally came into view. First written in 1995 and revised since, it was where his grand organizing scheme, the Four Quadrants, initially appeared. Laid out roughly the opposite of Life Divine, the first part of the book draws on front-edge science, in addition to everything else under the sun, to explain how life evolves into greater complexity and inclusiveness, ascension. The second part integrates this with a cosmological view of how a Platonic understanding of spirit descends to Earth and the way it has played out through the course of history. The W.C. Lattice has explanatory value for either direction, and now in the book I give the picture of it. So here in the audio, I'm going to have to describe the box, which is the WC lattice. You can imagine a box, a graph, with two axes up and across. Going up, we'll get these words: archaic, then magic, then mythic, then rational, then pluralistic, then integral, then super integral. So that's rising through levels of development. We call that vertical. Now, horizontal, it goes gross, subtle, causal, non-dual. And so you can imagine the graph with those two as the vertical axis and the horizontal axis, and then all the boxes filled in on the full graph. And that's the basic form of the WC lattice. So there are two boxes: vertical stages and horizontal states. The vertical axis charts lines of human development through successive stages. We all develop differently as we go through life, and this can be captured by different lines, which rise up through stage levels. For example, emotional line, interpersonal line, kinesthetic line, morals line, cognitive line. So there's different colors in the grid. The lowest colors are purple, and then it goes through brown and orange and yellow and green and blue and up into indigo. And so indigo being the highest levels of development, the purple being the lowest. Purple is archaic, and in this box, integral is, super integral is indigo. Now, each line is a slightly different region of the body and brain with different learning areas and skills. A variant on this approach to the diverse ways that people can learn and grow has also been offered by Howard Gardner with his well-received idea of multiple intelligences. Individual lines will climb up the vertical axis depending on the degree of evolutionary resource and endeavor the person might have and apply during her lifetime. And some lines for some individuals can eventually reach up to the purple or indigo super integral stage, or even above that. Different people are inclined toward different groups of lines, so some will push the emotional line up there, others kinesthetic, etc. Each stage has increasing degrees of inclusivity, embracing more of the cosmos, as well as increasing the sophistication of the patterns and algorithms of connection within that larger field. To reach a stage, one must satisfy certain criteria in this regard. These aren't tests with God sitting there, report card in hand, threatening to give us an F, so much as what Wilbur calls cosmic habits, or grooves, and they correspond to broad generalities that appear to reflect the way human body minds evolve over time. For those who are inherently or deliberately working at an evolutionary process, the claim of this grid is that it describes stations through which such individuals will progress, and once we actually understand the structures and vibrations at each level, we will naturally settle into them. Before that, these levels will be over our heads. However, and this is a glimpse into the complicated kinds of issues the lattice clarifies, other processes, such as yoga, take us along the horizontal axis, growth through states. It's not stages, but states. Regarding states, the WC lattice uses the classic divisions first set down in the Upanishads before the Common Era, which correlate spiritual states or yogic attainments with the main states of sleep. The gross nature column corresponds to normal waking consciousness. The subtle deity column corresponds to dreaming sleep. The causal formal column corresponds to deep sleep, also called nidra, yogi sleep. And the non-dual column corresponds to the ability to hold all of these states stably and hold two or even all three at once, i.e., realizing the causal state while functioning in gross and or subtle reality. This arranges the territory of the spiritual life into four basic divisions, which themselves have been further broken down into subdivisions in spiritual literature. Everybody, including the degenerate couch potato who stays as far away from yoga as possible, travels their way through these four basic states in their nightly sleep. But the spiritual life, as it has been expressed through cultures and time by adepts in different traditions, has described spiritual development as the realization of variations on these states of sleeping mind while still fully conscious. Many of us know of classic images of meditating yogis, whose eyes are rolled back in their head behind semi-closed lids. This also happens to the eyes of people during sex and orgasm. In 2003, I saw the Rolling Stones in India. Poured rain the moment they started and stopped the moment they got off stage. Daryl Jones, their bassist during that period, considered among the finest, had his eyes rolled back the entire time. These are examples of someone entering a zone similar to the dream state while still awake. In REM sleep, the eyes fly all over the place behind the lids, seeing things inside, or using the visual capacity to add dimension to internal subtle feeling. So, the beauty of the WC lattice is that it makes room in the cosmos for spirituality while it's still affirming and even supporting the manifest parts. It actually goes further than that because it casts the spiritual dimension as the ground from which the other parts rise. The aspect of existence that cannot readily be perceived by the big five outward senses is cast as the foundation of the whole thing. Now, here is the initial problem I had with SES before the lattice showed up. In that book, and a few later things, and in all of his previous books, Wilbur made no clear differentiation between states and stages, and simply placed the highest yogic states at the very top of the vertical axis, on top of the very highest states of cognitive, emotional, kinesthetic, and other types of achievement. As he later and wiser put it, bam, 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 east and west integrated. He also noted with hindsight that since the higher stages, quote unquote, have characteristics that appear similar to those of the three or four higher states, it was almost impossible to spot the difference, end quote. After reading the book, I sat there scratching my head for a while. It occurred to me that a scientist or a basketball player or even a hatha yogi who engages both an exercise part and a meditation spiritual part, with the latter often somewhat neglected in Western yoga class circles, could integrate himself way up an active developmental line, doing almost all his work in the gross waking state, barely scraping the subtle, and when he did only in an unconscious manner, and never getting anywhere near the causal state other than in his sleep. He could attain high levels on various vertical lines, but have zero conscious awareness or realization of the spiritual states. If you look at highly accomplished people in life, this is not an uncommon situation. Worldly frequently doesn't mean spiritual. It seemed to me that yogic spiritual states were a different kind of line, a certain mode of intelligence that unfolded in a learning way, just like the other lines, but one that often developed by omission rather than proliferation when seen from the gross perspective, and uncovered foundations within which our deepest identity dwelt, an identity far larger and more profound than the part of us which is the typical doer in any particular activity. It wasn't until I found the lattice and its addition of the horizontal line against the vertical line that I was satisfied with Wilbur's attempts to integrate human development with spirituality. So, let's look at Hatha Yoga development in this light. A person walks into her first of many Ashtanga classes. She brings with her a life history of somatomotor experiences which have given rise to a series of developments in the somatomotor systems in her body-mind. We'll call this her kinesthetic line on the vertical axis of the lattice. This history starts with wiggling around as a baby, reaching for things, trying to eat them, figuring out crawling, walking, running. For most of us, it develops from there. She's been using her somatomotor capacities nonstop since birth, and all this practice has entered data into her memory, and her brain and nerves have been crunching it up and putting things in the right places toward the goal of effective action, with much of this occurring beneath her awareness, unconsciously. The nerves have been making connections in an autopoetic fashion, organizing themselves following their own informed by experience yet subterranean will. And most interestingly, periodically through time, there have been incidents of global reorganization where suddenly a threshold is passed in the body-mind, many things shift at once, and the somatomotor movements, awareness of them, capacity to do them in the moment, and to put different pieces of them into coherent wholes, suddenly increases. She has moved up a level on the vertical axis. The crawler suddenly stands. Balance is added to the mix. The stander suddenly walks. Balance problems are now solved in a complex, spontaneous manner. Where can this go? Let's switch the example from yoga to sports, discuss issues around the higher reaches of development of the vertical somatomotor line. Then we'll pursue the horizontal potentials that yoga adds to this process. I spent the first 11 years of my life in Boston and my dad is an inveterate Celtics fan, pro basketball. Occasionally, we still watch. They advanced to the conference finals in 2012 and lost a great series. Their chief foe, LeBron James of the Miami Heat, aged 27 at the time. He had put in thousands of hours of intensely focused basketball practice and play by that point. He had probably attained the lauded 10,000 hours by the time he was 20. Much of it in heightened prana environments during games, often with millions watching, thousands actually in his physical space, the rest on TV. He was putting together spontaneously improvised moves of enormous complexity, every fraction of a second presenting the possibility for large numbers of new adjustments, each one coming both from his internal tool bag, partly conscious, partly unconscious, and modified on the fly. All NBA players do this. But for a good percentage of the games he plays, he operates at a vertical level up, or more, on most of the other players. Greater complexity and thus greater options for new arrangements. Or as they say in neurology, greater calculation speed through more efficient signal routing and richer, higher level representations. That which less advanced players would see as a chaotic situation, he sees as a whole. Where others see a mess, he sees a pattern. And there's another force operating on that floor too, one with implications for yoga and longevity. Another great player, Paul Pierce, age 34 at the time. More hours logged in the court than LeBron, which means that his toolbox likely has more relevant information to work with, and also very high level, but having to add another twist into the neurological data crunching. All that time, and all that physical intensity, has left him with a few strained and even broken parts. He knows more than when he was 27, but his musculoskeletal body can't do what it used to do. He can still evolve along the vertical axis of somatomotor development, which is largely neurological, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's better at winning basketball games than a young guy whose gross body parts aren't broken down yet. In this particular series, the beat-up smart old guys held their own until the structurally sounder young guys finally passed them right at the end. Basketball, like ballet, is a young person's game. 34 and you're nearly over the hill. But yoga is a different story. Hopefully. One of the points I want to get to a little later is that conscious residence in the subtle realm is a huge contributor to creativity, such as our bass player above. Eyes roll back, that's the zone from which his creativity flows. Those who have managed to get themselves to the higher states have the potential to tap a special creative fund that can be applied toward gross level artistic and other forms. And in Hatha Yoga, as opposed to basketball, gaining traction along the horizontal path of the lattice, along the states corresponding to sleep, is really the basic intention of the practice, at least as it has developed in Indian history. NBA basketball, and much of the material world, is about winning and money, so that vertical stages, and aggression and luck, rule the roost. Yoga is about enlightenment and happiness, and these need some horizontal progress, something that is known to mature with age if valued and given a chance, with the potential of getting progressively more developed, even as the physical body wears down, i.e., into old age. Back to the basketball players. A typical non-mystical player will put in hard practice time during gross waking hours and then sleep at night. What happens within him as he sleeps? On the simply physical level, sleep is a time of maximum anabolic activity, growth and repair activity. It is when the body's response to exercise happens the most. The complex process of muscle upregulation along with neural growth and neural organization. This is also when more severe strains and injury heal most quickly, partly because deep sleep is when the most growth hormone is released. Yogis can take a unique kind of advantage of this, see below. I'll get to that in a bit. At the neurological level, things get very interesting during sleep. A prominent theory in current brain science is that memories stored from experience are quote-unquote interleaved in a progressive process into the cortex from the hippocampus, with this happening the fastest during sleep. The hippocampus stores memories short-term, the cortex stores them long-term. and they get put in the right places in the cortex. Essentially, impressions received by the body mind are organized autopoetically into coherent, intelligent patterns, the process being steered by the same kind of wisdom that guides the cells in their profoundly complex operations. An almond has around 21 amino acids. When we eat one, we do not need to worry about where to put them or what to do with them. The body does it for us and does it with a nearly incomprehensible biochemical genius. Likewise, I'm drawing a parallel to what the brain does, especially during sleep, with the daily intake of data. If our player has actually done a lot of basketball that day, these impressions will arrange themselves. If he sits around watching crap TV all day, those impressions will arrange themselves, poor guy. If he does lots of focused basketball practice day after day, he will, without conscious effort on his part other than the practicing itself, begin neurologically developing higher order representations and longer lines of association, brain items which indicate degrees of mastery. He puts in the focused basketball time, his self-organizing body-mind does the rest. This physical and neurological progress also happens during waking hours. But if sleep doesn't happen, if he never moves horizontally along the lattice, he will eventually catabolize, break down, the opposite of anabolize. And it doesn't take long. The feeling we get at the end of a long, hard day is that of our subtle and gross systems wearing down. They call out to us to get horizontal, both in bed and along the WC lattice. Once rest and sleep begin, then everything suddenly switches to the positive, and the strong impressions received from the tough day become the evolutionary fuel for greater development, for both vertical and horizontal attainment. And those who advance furthest in this life, along either axis, have a hunger for strong impressions. Our basketball player is going to need to get himself way up that vertical axis if he wants any chance to make it in the NBA. Couch potato lifestyle ain't gonna work. And his nightly sleep can be seen as a matrix which regularly, reliably, miraculously brings him into the force that can get him there. Vertical development in the gross waking state cannot happen without regular passes through the deeper horizontal stages. Put differently, regular passes along the horizontal axis are required to get anything going vertically. Yoga is the art of getting into these horizontal stages while still fully awake. So, returning then to the grand revelation I mentioned earlier, the one I thought I was onto as I read Sex, Ecology, Spirituality. For a long time, I had a burning question. How can Hatha Yoga bring us to the highest goals of the yoga traditions? By that time, I had settled on my understanding of the tantric ideal as the best way to live a yogi's life, an approach to the time given us in this life, which is fully aware of the material world and alive to its dynamic forces and participates in these forces, but is also able to tap into the deeper realms of consciousness. Not all spiritual people have chosen to live in the world this way. I'll get to that in a bit. The great paradox at the heart of Tantra, of which Hatha Yoga is a branch, emerges when we take even a perfunctory tour through the corpus of yogic and Buddhist literature and the fact of the drashtu, or seer, or Brahman, or witness, or causal matrix. In the WC lattice, it is represented by the dark night causal column along the horizontal axis. There are many more names for it. Jumps out at us. It can't be ignored, and is clearly set out ad nauseum as the goal of spiritual life and the realization of enlightenment, either integrated with the grosser realms or not. This causal matrix is not a thing per se, but is the absence of things. It is not the result of our yogic efforts, but rather the presence that was there the whole time and is only with a moment of recognition and, in a mysterious fashion as a result of our efforts, been uncovered. Okay, no problem. But the burning question and my urgent internal issue I mentioned at the beginning of this chapter. How does all this relate to active life and practice, such as Hatha Yoga, where we aren't doing nothing, but rather are developing something? Like most meditations, Hatha Yoga is a deployment of attention, and that very attention develops the contents upon which it focuses. Also, it is a practice that develops hierarchically, and as Wilbur puts it, holarchically. What does hierarchical development of contents have to do with spiritual life? Here's an example of a Hatha Yoga move higher up the hierarchy. Karandavasana is an ungodly difficult asana, two-thirds of the way through second series in Ashtanga. It puts together several pieces of things which require development time on their own. To begin, one must be able to do lotus, and for some, this is a huge hip-opening undertaking unto itself, requiring full attention. For many people, putting the parts of lotus together is as much as they can do at their present level of practice. If things are given a chance to progress with practice, all the separate openings and movements required for lotus become unified in a coherent whole. The many have become one. The same goes for the next part of Karandavasana, which is forearm balance. The strength and balance may take a while to develop before any kind of success sets in. We then put these two together, lotus and arm balance. And there's even more to the asana than that. I don't need to go any further with this description to convey the main point, which is a different angle of my take on LeBron James from above. To achieve Karandavasana, one must put together multiple holes, which themselves are comprised of multiple holes, each of which needed learning and development time before it could even be realized as a whole. Before that, we were just struggling through the parts, which themselves can be broken into parts, which themselves, you get the idea. Development with an active life and practices, the vertical axis on the lattice, proceeds through the transformation of parts into wholes, which then become parts of larger wholes, on and on as far as we have the guts to keep going. This is progress up the vertical axis of the lattice. And the thing that was bugging me, when and how does this process eventually help us to get over to the subtle realm, or especially the causal matrix, which is, gasp, nothing, nothing at all? How does hierarchical physical attainment uncover the blockages to our recognition of the causal matrix? Here is how I viewed the problem. We can keep doing asanas for years, and while we get physically fit and better at performing the asanas, what exactly about it is spiritual? Does spiritual progress just sort of show up one day? Why don't we even want it? One clue to answering these questions has to do with that which happens to us as we focus our minds. Most yoga teachers at least make some reference to quieting the mind and staying in the present moment. Many also emphasize focusing on the breath, and in Ashtanga, hopefully these guidances are overt. Making attempts to focus the mind on an actual sensate field in the present moment, which is different than giving energy to memories and plans for the future, and adding breath control to this, transforms Hatha Yoga from, quote-unquote, just exercise, as Padabi Joyce used to say, to something greater. The goal of the yogi is stable residence in either subtle material or in a realm where the word material isn't relevant at all. All gross-level goals in yoga are subsidiary to these. Notice that the overt goal of the basketball game is to win the game and or entertain the people. Wilbur's earlier all-vertical model didn't work because it never made the yogic shift that turns the project of getting better at the asanas into a calm observation while material work is being done. The addition of the horizontal axis was needed to make calm observation both a skill that we get better at and one that can transform any and all gross level improvement projects into spiritual ones. The horizontal axis can also be seen for its potential to infuse the get better at project with unusual creativity. Think of what it is like to dream. Unending, inexhaustible creative energy toward the presentation of stories. What's the source of that creativity? Two things begin happening at once to the yogi. One, time spent doing the asanas will have its developmental effects on her body, upgrading it, developing it, neurologically stimulating the generation of higher order representations, etc. Movement up the vertical axis of the lattice, particularly in a somatomotor line. But then two, what does a steady mental focus and breath do? My answer. It can simultaneously move her into the inner sheaths, Sanskrit is koshas, of existence. And these contain phenomena and connections with qualities different than those of the gross waking state. Dreaming sleep is viewed as a sheath interior to gross waking states, and deep sleep is seen as interior to dreaming. Mental focus and conscious breath will generate horizontal movement along the lattice. Calm observation will eventually move us toward the subtle spheres. Seated meditation is a way to get horizontal without the distraction of bodily movement. One aspect of seated meditation is that it's the absence of doing anything. We've pared it all down to inner focus, minimizing distractions. Of course, what is really happening is just a more simple and subtle version of Hatha Yoga, because the back and neck muscles are still working and the hips are being stretched. And anyone who has gone on meditation retreat knows that around day three, these areas begin to express their opinion about the forces to which they are being subjected. Hatha Yoga, rightly understood, is a meditation with an elaborate physical aspect, with a recognition that as long as we are on this planet, we have a body to deal with. At some point along this act of focusing and noticing, or as has been in the West, praying and contemplating, the body-mind begins to move into a realm where different kinds of things present themselves. And these things take a form akin to the dreaming body-mind. Less logical, more visionary and flowing, more connected to spheres of subtle energy, heartfelt, transcendent to the time and space of the practitioner's body. Psycho-spiritual technology, East and West, has developed as a way of getting us there and beyond. The path is robust and has been repeated countless times all over the world. There appears to be an innate human curiosity to follow the roads opened within us every night as we sleep, but to follow them while awake, and to plumb their depths with our witnessing consciousness fully aware. In the yogic literature, this path is said to reveal and eventually integrate and or let go of our samskaras, a word which can be translated as past experiences unconsciously held in the body-mind. Before conscious revelation, they give us hints to their existence within us by manifesting as vrittis, or subtle fluctuations of consciousness, and the classic goal of the yogi is to get them quieted down. This quieting process has a paradoxical effect. The yogi learns skill and gains strength at moving from discursive mind to yoga mind, but that very act of quieting will simultaneously activate the samskara to reveal more of itself, as if the deeper psyche senses that the appropriately prepared environment of yoga mind is a good setting to bring strong and relevant unconscious material to the surface. Also notice right away the parallel to the dreaming mind of normal sleep, seen in many of the mature psychological arts and sciences as the revelation to the psyche of previously hidden unconscious stuff, a gift of the unconscious, which night by night slowly reveals us to ourselves and provides the possibility of getting some purchase on the task of mastering our inner demons by providing us with objects to work with. On the yogic path, this stuff must be integrated before we can stably go further into the subtle realm. At a point in this integration process, the yogi will attain stable adaptation at some percentage of the subtle level, which is akin to learning asanas at the gross level. By akin, I mean this. A person can want to do handstand, can visualize doing it, but basically nobody can just go right into it and stay in it without first practicing to the point where the strength is built and the nerves know what to do. And so it is with the negotiation of subtle currents. Actual adaptation at the multiple levels of the subtle realm is the result of subjecting oneself to the vrittis and gaining the soul skills which will organize themselves following adequate time invested in the vritti-laden subtle environment. And it can't be easy, although some have more gifts here than others, old souls. Just as parenting can't be easy because kids will go until they find their parents' edge, unconscious stuff is by its very nature not something that we have been holding in awareness, and therefore can be likened to a song that we simply haven't consciously listened to yet, although we may have vaguely heard it playing in the background. We need to hear it a few times before we can sing along. Another mystery of sleep. At some point as we lie down at night, we get taken by the dreaming mind. If we have any will in the switch from waking to dreaming, it is in our will to relax. Those who are good sleepers have the gift or acquired skill of getting themselves into the place where the dreams can take them. And likewise, the move to deep sleep. It follows on its own once we've hit the layers of the dreaming state. It claims us. And thus it goes with the spiritual life, and those who have attained to the mysterious and elusive causal or yoga nidra state. Having brought themselves by their skill at the yogic meditative contemplative inquiry arts to the place where subtle phenomena present themselves, at some point of penetration into the subtle state, and this expression of it seems to be universal, they get surprised, grabbed, engulfed, claimed, taken, submerged, as an act of grace, by profound stillness and quietude, which presents itself as more real than normal waking reality, indeed which appears to be the matrix from which normal waking reality originates, the womb of the whole thing. In fact, a reticence and reluctance to turn to daily life can be a byproduct of this realization. Spiritual people become less material because they have found something better. How many of us enjoy being awakened from deep sleep? Adept yogis can get themselves to these higher states at will, and sometimes quite rapidly. Once the state territory, the horizontal axis has been objectified and traversed several many times. There's a very interesting implication here toward healing. If the yogi can maximize her stay in the subtle and or causal realm while still awake and functioning to varying degrees in the gross realm, she will have access to the organizational and healing powers of sleep while still awake. As previously mentioned, without sleep, body and mind begin falling apart. Death from complete insomnia occurs around 11 days. Again, research has shown extensive aspects of how dreaming sleep promotes mental organization in the waking state, as well as the fact that the body releases the most growth hormone during sleep. Long-term yogis, including meditators, exhibit various well-developed brain regions and are relatively free of many stress-related health issues, indicating that conscious relaxation does more than just free one of tension, but also generates positive healing evolutionary metabolism. Sleep researchers have often commented on how sleep is not a low-energy conservation state, but actually a time when the brain burns through calories with heavy neuron firing. Studies on meditators show that when they frequently move in and out of light sleep states while practicing, which can be interpreted as a conscious cultivation of the states of sleep, as an illuminating of the transition between awareness and sleep. The history of renunciated East and West includes many individuals who have decided that as long as they have the ability to consciously hang out in these deep sleep spaces, then typical waking human life has little draw for them. On this issue, Sri Aurobindo, a deliberately transformational figure within Indian spirituality, had a bone to pick with the Rishis who preceded him. His quote is, "Through many centuries, a great army of shining witnesses, saints, and teachers, named sacred to Indian memory and dominant in Indian imagination, have borne always the same witness and swelled always the same lofty and distant appeal. Renunciation, sole path of knowledge. Acceptation of physical life, the act of the ignorant. Cessation from birth, the right use of human birth. The call of the spirit, the recoil from matter." He helped found the city of Auroville in an attempt to realize the physical in harmony with the spiritual. And herein lies a vindication of Hatha Yoga and the beauty of the WC lattice. For my 3 cents, Hatha Yoga is the path par excellence for integrating gross and subtle states, which allows the subtle planes of existence to consciously coexist with the gross realm, as well as sublimating gross phenomena up to the subtle. By witnessing our gross level projects and recognizing the importance of the witnessing process itself, we can make any activity into a Hatha Yoga. Doing the dishes, playing basketball, having sex, holding as many horizontal depths as we have access to while we go about our lives, very much in the world and yet evolving beyond worldly concerns through our very participation in that world. How does worldly participation help spirituality? Why not just renounce it all and go into a cave and ignore the body? When considering such a cave yogi, we see a person who has radically limited his inputs and, if successful in the long line of cave yogidom, has thereby managed to sit in his cave and enact non-dual mental perspective. But what if real estate guys develop the land where his cave is and he needs to go into the city? How will he do with attractive women walking around with the need to have money, etc.? Surrounded by these things, he may well discover that his samskaras begin flying. His limited experience has left him clueless to many of them, and his non-dual perspective vanishes. Conscious engagement with the body and life, placing value on calm observation and mental quietude, can be the tortoise to the cave yogi's hair, slower, but bringing about the whole thing with you, and durable. Mastering both spirit and the world will not always be easier than focusing on one or the other, but it's better. Pattabhi Joyce likened this to that of a woman walking along with a bucket full of water on her head, a common sight in the Indian countryside, and one which is dauntingly difficult at first, but eventually appears effortless, bringing God down to earth, living the spiritual life in the material world. While others are merely walking along, the accomplished tantric is keeping track of a much bigger project. And is it ironic that many of the women doing this are quite beautiful to look at? Is it ironic that the human form doing hatha yoga is often among the most beautiful incarnate sites to be found? Hatha yoga is India's great gift to the world. It is the realization of how to bring the Rishi's profound dedication to the horizontal axis, to the higher yogic states, back down to the very muscles and skin of the waking state, which stimulates the body-mind up to the higher reaches of evolutionary development. It is the horizontal progress itself that allows extraordinary vertical progress to happen. The WC lattice has room for both heaven and earth. I'll say it differently. Although many seekers who have achieved the further horizontal states can show an indifference to the vertical realm of material life, either because they lean in the cave yogi direction, or they have actually diffused some or all of the drama of worldly existence by living in it, the great gift of higher spiritual states is the beautiful, elegant organization they present to the material realms, should the yogi choose to return to them. In the yoga tradition, one way to express this was through the cities, flying around, ability to read minds and disappear, to shrink, to grow, to be two places at once, walk on water, that kind of thing, you know, abilities beyond the ken of typical people, said to be acquired by higher yogis because their spiritual achievements allowed them an entirely uncommon penetration into gross, mundane matter. Many of these cities are somewhat fanciful, but your ability to use yogic skills to radically develop your own abilities is anything but fanciful. And the causal, the next step beyond the subtle, is called the causal matrix because from the mystical eye, from the eye of one who has experienced it, the forms that make up the world emanate originally from this place. It is the source of form, from very subtle form to gross form. Sri Aurobindo called it massed consciousness. Those who travel the spiritual path open the possibility of understanding and participating in world creation itself. The preeminent techniques for causal realization seem to require relative stillness of body and mind, such as seated or lying down meditations. But the time spent mastering and continuing to master hatha yoga can get the yogi to a robustly supported place in the subtle realms where, inviting the causal in and everything ready, divine rapture hovering, she gets taken.